Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An eight-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim. Nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 497, An Introduction. Carol Quigley opens Chapter 11 with the following statement, air quotes, "An economic system does not have to be expansive, that is, constantly increasing its production of wealth. It might well be possible for people to be completely happy in a non-expansive economic system, if they were accustomed to it." Interesting point of view here. However, I could not envisage any industrialist being too happy in relation to any economic system being tweaked to curtail their individual opportunities for personal wealth enhancement. Moreover, at this juncture, Quigley provides no examples of what a non-expansive economic system might look like. Quigley goes on to point out that the 20th century was characterized by expansionist economics, and as such, that there was an expectation by individuals that they should be better off each year than they were the previous year. Okay. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Personally, I don't think it is. Why? Well, after all, people in employment within the system are daily giving of their limited time, limited energy. Therefore, they actually are entitled to expect a meaningful return as a result of their inputs to the system, just as the industrialist who employs them expects a meaningful return from the wages he or she pays to the employee. Moreover, as nothing in life ever remains the same, why would anyone assume that any non-expansive economic system would just chug along merrily and not, for whatever reason, at some point, incline towards decline, and maybe even eventual collapse? Some might argue, and reasonably so, that a non-expansive economic system could ultimately lead to a stagnation, that is, diminishing opportunities for the evolution of new ideas, new products, and new services. A reasonable argument. Quigley goes on to confirm for us that investment is the lifeblood of any economic system. That is, investment starts the business, allows for the employment of people, pays the people for their work, allows the people, therefore, to have money to live and to buy products and services. He goes on to state that if the aforementioned linkages, for whatever reason, decline or fail, then obviously people are left with no money to buy stuff. Allied to the aforementioned, Quigley reminds us that purchasing power, which, for whatever reason, becomes diverted into savings, causes an accumulation of goods produced, which then become surplus, and as such knock out of kilter the basic law of supply and demand. He suggests that savings are needed back into the market by way of investments to, in a manner of speaking, reprime the economic pump, Quigley holds the view that people seeking to improve their own position in the short term tend to have a negative impact upon the system in the long term. Interesting point here. I would find it difficult to believe that, in such consideration, Quigley was referring to ordinary Joes and or Janes. I mean, what ordinary workaday individual who was on the cusp of making a decision to pursue a course of action which might improve their lot or the lot of their family would first stop to consider if such proposed action was going to, in some way or other in the future, negatively impact the economic system. In a free world, in a free nation, not a chance. Besides, to the majority of people, if not to all, the system is but a remote, intangible thing, while the person is an individual, underpinned with free will, and mostly with a drive towards the protection and betterment, typically of themselves, and indeed their families. Quigley contends that throughout the 19th century, a basic economic tenet was, what was good for the individual was good for society. As such, harmony of interests became a significant driving paradigm within economics. If one considers the use of the term good in individual context to mean that which is not harmful, then yes, such as like as not would be good also for society as a whole, and therefore, by extension, the striving towards a harmony of interest in terms of both consumers and producers, that is, people and business, would absolutely be a good thing, albeit nonetheless, by dint of necessity, a sustained work in progress. Quigley goes on to suggest that within the economics of the 19th century, harmony was assumed to exist between one individual and another. In my humble opinion, cognizant of human nature, to say the very least, this was a brave and a risky assumption. While nodding agreement towards the harmony theory of the 19th century, Quigley nonetheless expresses doubt that such a theory could be carried forward successfully into the 20th century without considerable modification. Surprise, surprise, human nature is the problem again. Quigley suggests that because individuals sought to look after their own interests, such actions modified economic organization, and did so to such a degree that the actions of one person, like the concentric outward rippling rings following the casting of a stone into still water, was likely to connect with and injure his fellows, society as a whole, and his own long-range advantage. Interesting. Sounds to me like Quigley is admonishing a kind of existing laissez-faire economics, that is, an economic model which was prevalent back in the 18th century. Perhaps it never really went away. Quigley goes on to allude to an apparent conflict within the then prevailing economic theory and the then actual economic practice, and suggests a need for a return to the fundamentals of economics, together with an admission that 20th century economics was very complex. Innovation, savings and investment, Quigley notes, are essential for economic progress, and society must be geared towards the provision of all three, or it will not expand economically. New and better means of production must be achieved through innovation. He then goes on to suggest that savings must be used as a means of refraining from consumption of resources that could otherwise be mobilized for other purposes, and that investment means the mobilization of resources into new and better ways of production. Quigley directs us towards investment, or lack thereof, as being the most frequent cause of the failure in economic progress. He goes on to suggest that savings directed towards spending in general consumption, in indulgence in ostentatious social prestige, in war, in religion, and in other non-productive areas, or even left unspent, are all negatives from the point of view of economic progress. So, Mr. Oligarch, there goes your luxury home, and your luxury yacht. And Mr. Yuppie, there goes your brand new top-of-the-range car every year. Oh, I can feel your pain. And coming towards the close of Chapter 11 Introduction, Quigley visits the Vested Interest Brigade, by stating that progress, and that is what's understood to be the movement from the old to the new, benefits some, but not all. He cautions that if the group in society who controls the savings are the same individuals who benefit from the existing way of doing things, then they are in a position to defend the status quo, and as such, prevent progress by preventing the use of financial surpluses to finance new innovations. Quigley declared the 20th century in economic terms to have been one of crisis, and pointed out that without an examination of developments in the chief capitalist countries, we would be unable to discover the cause of said crisis. End of introduction. And there's more, much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.